From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. Peace on earth, goodwill to all. More than ever before, that's our wish to you and yours this difficult Christmas weekend. As we resolutely hold out hope for a better year ahead, we're bringing you some of our favorite conversations from years past.
'Twas the night before
Christmas.
This is a very Christian time of the year indeed in our country. On this week's show, I'll talk to Rabbi Brad Hirschfield about how to get the most out of this season if you're not Christian, and find some commonalities among the world's religions as the year draws to a close. Yes, Virginia, there really is a Santa Claus, or at least there was, reimagined by the Coca-Cola Company, relocated from Turkey to the North Pole. The legend is one thing, but the charitable church history-making bishop profiled in the new book, The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus, The True Life and Trials of Nicholas of Myra, is in many ways an equally appealing figure, even without the reindeer. And on this week's show, I will talk to the book's author, religion historian Adam English.
The way we feel God is through love. When I look back over my life, you know, from a little boy, I can sense those moments when God was like, here I am.
Those are the words of a Texas pastor who's built a remarkable ministry of no-nonsense theology, nurturing community, and a passion for social justice. Rudy Rasmus has followed an undeniably non-traditional path to the pulpit of Houston's 9,000-member, improbably diverse St. John's United Methodist Church. And on this week's show, you'll hear his inspiring story.
The rooms are full at Bethlehem Inn, but there's a rustic barn out back that is quite charming, and the hay is complimentary.
You remember Janet Reese, who spent 4 years summarizing every chapter of the Bible and tweeting them? Now, the best of those tweets have been released in book form, and just in time for the holiday, she's back on State of Belief with some seasonal scripture in 140 characters or less. Jana, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations on the release of the book. Since we're well into the Christmas season, I was hoping you would share some seasonal scripture in twibble form.
All right. Well, so I chose 12 tweets of Christmas. And these are taking people through the birth of Jesus all the way through the resurrection of Jesus. So as you can imagine, there's a lot that's left out, but I hope this will get the gist of the story and be entertaining too.
Okay.
All right, the 12 tweets of Christmas. 1. Just when you thought we'd left the Old Testament, here's a string of begats to put you at ease. Ancestry.com says JC's descended from David. Woot! 2. Astrologers are sent on a field trip to find a Messiah child somewhere out west. Quote, a star. Could you be more specific? Unquote. 3. Teen girl Mary, chosen by G, to bear the Savior. Okay, the pregnancy raises some eyebrows, but a double thumbs up to Joseph for loyalty. 4. Quote, ma'am, the rooms are full at Bethlehem Inn, but there's a rustic barn out back that is quite charming, and the hay is complimentary, unquote. 5. Taste of Galilee is a hit when J.C. feeds 5,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fish. Can he also multiply chocolate cake for dessert? 6. J.C. uses his own saliva to heal a man born blind. So the first thing the guy sees is a stranger spitting on him. Hello, cruel world. 7. J.C., quote, love one another as I have loved you, unquote. It's really not much to ask, you know, just be willing to die for others. Oh, there's that. 8. J.C. raises a girl from the dead. Good thing she was only 12. If she'd been a teen, she would have slept all day until she wanted to get up. 9. The 12 freak out when JC wants to wash their feet, but at least he doesn't use his own spit this time. That's progress. 10. There's nothing funny about Jesus dying on a cross. Sorry. Catch up with me in the next chapter. 11. Ooh. Doubting Tom mauls JC's wounds to make sure his resurrection's the real deal. JC, quote, ouch, couldn't you just take my word for it, unquote. And 12, JC to Pete, quote, do you love me with agape love, unquote. Pete, quote, sure, I friended you 3 times on Facebook, unquote. JC, quote, fair enough, feed my lambs, unquote.
Jenna, talk briefly about the process of curating the multi-year Bible tweeting project into book form.
I like the word curating. That's a wonderful thing because I think that is a lot of what's going on here, taking the gist of a story, trying to distill it down to its narrative, but also trying to make it fresh and entertaining to people in the culture that we live in today. Not always easy. Some of the passages were a little bit hard to relate to modern life, especially Leviticus, for example, or the mm-hmm. Book of Numbers. But some of it is just timeless and wonderful.
The hard work of taking something that we all think we know well and then reworking it into a different form can provide truly unique insights. There's an element of a monk painstakingly hand-lettering the Bible in ancient times to your work. What did getting this intimate with the Bible do to you? Did you find something new? Did you feel something different?
I found new things almost every day. You know, there are 1,189 chapters of the Bible, which is a long time of your life if you're tweeting it out one chapter a day. And so that pace required me to spend a lot of time with the text and also with commentary so I could see what other people were saying about it. And so, yes, I learned a ton. For example, I learned something that I never knew about the first temple in Jerusalem, which was that it was probably only about 2,700 square feet. We think of this temple, you know, Solomon's temple, as being a huge, grand, amazing wonder of the ancient world. But in fact, it was not that large. You know, you could fit about 100 of them in a Walmart supercenter today. Hmm. So thinking about that in scale was really interesting to me. I learned a ton.
What do you, when you think about a reader going through your book, talking about the Twible, what do you hope readers get out of that? What do you want them to feel or think when they put it down?
Well, that's a great question. A couple of things. The first is I want them to laugh. I want them to have a wonderful time with the Bible. I think people are so many times so intimidated by the Bible and kind of afraid to try it, or they feel that they should know more about it than they do. So the Twible, you know, seeks to entertain. And then the second thing I hope is that they will be educated. You know, they will leave this reading experience not only laughing, but more informed about the Bible and looking at it as an overall story rather than just trying to understand little tiny bits of it, but getting the bird's eye view of the whole Bible. I just had a pastor buy 20 copies of it for his confirmation class, which I thought was wonderful. You know, he thinks that it's a good way for 8th and 9th graders to understand the Bible and to not think of the Bible as something that's boring or something that's for other people, but something that's for them.
Dr. Jenna Reese is a scholar, a writer, an author. Her latest project is The Twible, all the chapters of the Bible in 140 characters or less, now with 68% more humor. You may even think it's more than 68%. I've described Jenna's work in the past as irreverent but always respectful, and that certainly continues to be true. Jenna, it really wouldn't be right for us to do a real long interview with someone as interested as you are in getting it abbreviated. So let me just say Merry Christmas and thank you for once again being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, and I wish you the best of Christmases.
Same to you. We'll be right back with Pastor Rudy Rasmus, who leads a Houston church that brings together an amazingly diverse congregation and performs amazingly diverse outreach to the neediest among us. You're listening to the best of State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. This weekend, we're bringing you some of our favorite inspiring stories from past years. Non-traditional doesn't even begin to describe Pastor Rudy Rasmus' story. A former brothel owner, he spent the past 21 years growing St. John's United Methodist Church in Houston, Texas, from 9 to 9,000 members, and touching many, many more thousands along the way. The congregation is notable for both its incredible diversity and its broad outreach to those in need, and I am so very pleased to have Pastor Rudy join me now on State of Belief Radio. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing, Reverend Gaddy?
Would you please explain a little bit about the history of the church, your background, how you got into the church and came to be doing what you're doing?
Well, I tell you, my daddy taught me to never trust preachers and church people. He said they were all full of something, and I believed him, which means it took me a long time to actually get to the church. Uh-huh. But I met a girl that I fell in love with who was a church girl, and when we married, I followed her to church, and I sat on the pew, Reverend Gaddy, for 5 years, really looking for what normally people in my background normally look for with church people, and that is fraud and hustle, you know. But I sat on that pew week after week, year after year, and for 5 years. I discovered that those people who told me they loved me actually meant it. And ultimately, I became a Christian, took a step almost immediately out of my family business, which was that, well, we actually call it a borderline brothel versus full-fledged. Because, you know, that's really illegal, you know what I mean?
Oh, I see. Okay.
But borderline, really, from the standpoint, this business was really, it was a sexually oriented business designed for the prostitution trade.
I see.
And it was really a crazy business, and I was in that business my entire adult life.
Good grief.
Yeah. And you know, when I came to church, ultimately becoming a Christian, almost immediately I felt a real compelling urge to do something good. Now, that's a big word, good.
Sure.
But I felt the urge to do something good, and ultimately, the ministers and pastors on the church campus where I became part of the faith, actually, you know, gave me some direction in terms of ministry. Mm-hmm. I didn't know really what ministry meant,
right.
but one particular pastor told me one day it meant to serve, and that was it.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think I can anticipate your answer, but what do you attribute the astounding growth of your membership to? I mean, we're talking about going from 9 to 9,000 members.
You know, we have really discovered the power of unconditional love. That is love without conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And often, you know, it's just kind of crazy, but instinctively, there, as human beings, we place conditions on the person in front of us as to whether or not we're going to accept that person for who they are and where they are.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at this church in Houston, Texas, St. John's, we have, from the first day, approached every human being that has walked through the door with the love, what I call the unconditional love of God,
mm-hmm.
and the power, the transformative power of this love in a person's life, regardless to where they are. I mean, now imagine this. This congregation comes from 150 zip codes. That means every neighborhood in Houston is represented on the pew. Isn't that crazy?
It is, yeah.
Every neighborhood. Amazing. But the one common denominator for every person, be it black, white, straight, gay, rich, poor, educated, uneducated, homeless, or seven bedrooms, is the need for love and the pain that we all drag through life. And that common denominator comes to that place, and ultimately we find ourselves not only in community, but as family.
Rudy, how do you, and this is the big challenge, I think, in religion, whatever the religion is, but how do you translate unconditional love into palpable ways of outreach so that people who don't know what you're talking about when you say unconditional love, how do they learn it?
You know, and we have really had to instruct over the years, because it's not something instinctive for just the average human being.
Mm-hmm.
This unconditional love really is the practice and the process of accepting the person in front of you and understanding that person's need for the same compassion that you need.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's an exercise, and we teach this exercise in our faith community, and we call it the compassion exercise.
Mm.
But imagine this. You are face-to-face with a person who is the other. That means the person that you probably would never share a cup of coffee with in any point in your life. You're standing face-to-face with the other. And the exercise is to look at that person and say to yourself, just like me, that person needs love. That person needs compassion. That person needs to be understood. If I tell you that is the hardest thing for a person to do, but once you do it, it becomes the easiest thing to do.
Sure. What are the forms of outreach, the ministries, the substance of the ministries, the kinds of service that come out of your church as an expression of that?
The primary outreach that we've been involved in for the 22 years that we've been in that place has been to the homeless community in and around downtown Houston. When we got to this building, Reverend Gaddy, in 1992, there were homeless folks sleeping literally on the doorsteps. And when we got to that doorstep, we had a choice. We could step over that person and close the door behind us, or we could awaken that person and bring them in with us. We just decided to bring the folk in with us. And from that moment, it was clear that our primary mission was going to be to marginalized people. Now what we've discovered over these 20 years is that marginalization extends beyond homelessness.
Sure.
And we've extended the circle to every marginalized people group over these 20 years that would ultimately find themselves not welcomed at church. We say, okay, so you don't feel comfortable at church, come hang out with us. and that is an amazing, amazing outreach to a city where people for the most part all over the country don't really feel comfortable in church often, unless they were church folk, at some point along the way, and have what we also call situational esteem. So you have to have a certain esteem, self-esteem, mm-hmm. to walk into some rooms, and you have to have a lot of self-esteem to walk into most church rooms.
What part of what you do you find most rewarding?
I'll give you an example. a dear friend of mine just lost a child.
Mm-hmm.
And in that process of losing that child, this close friend of mine contemplated the relevance of God.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did from the moment that that child's illness through that child's funeral, I showed consistent love and compassion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What my friend told me a couple of days ago, right after the child's funeral, he said, "Rudy, you helped me stay in this thing called faith."
Yeah.
By the tangible evidence of your love. So the reward for me was a person experiencing the love of God through my actions.
Yeah. I want to go all the way back now to one of the first things that you told me, and that is you said that in your former life, you didn't trust ministers, you didn't trust churches. What is it now that you're in a church, now that you are a minister, and you have those memories of how you felt, what are you conscientiously doing that you wish someone had done to you early in life?
You know, at St. John's, we call it pimp proofing. We pimp proof our congregation to help them to be resilient when it comes to the unfortunate experiences in many churches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what happened early on is that my dad always equated preachers to pimps.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've done at St. John's in an effort to counteract that presence or even that belief is one, we've been extremely consistent as expressions of ministry.
Mm-hmm.
So number two, we have not necessarily lived the shiniest, blingiest life.
Mm-hmm.
I drive a 13-year-old pickup truck, and I'm pretty comfortable in that truck, and it can, you know, people expect me to drive something different.
Mm-hmm.
I've never worn a suit in this building for worship services over the last 20 years, and there's a there's an expectation that, you know, that I am supposed to be you know, shinier than anybody on the pew.
Mm-hmm.
In the process, I have demonstrated what I mentioned earlier, and that is the presence of unconditional acceptance for every person who's walked through the door.
Mm.
And that demonstration really has been more powerful than my 13-year-old truck, my blue jeans, and my lack of shininess.
Yeah,
you know, it's the acceptance that has made the biggest difference in people moving through their isms and the big chasm that exists between people in the church at this particular place.
Pastor Rudy Rasmus is co-pastor of St. John's United Methodist Church in Houston, Texas. This incredibly diverse congregation is deeply involved in outreach and social justice efforts. I think you know now why I said non-traditional doesn't even begin to describe this man and the congregation in which he ministers and to the community which he ministers. And I'm so pleased that on this particular show we could have you, Pastor Rudy, in our presence and sharing your story with us. I thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio, and wish blessings on you and your church.
Thank you, Reverend Gaddy.
you're hearing some of our favorite interviews from the past 15 years of this program. Joining me now is religion historian Adam English, whose new book, The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus, The True Life and Trials of Nicholas of Myra. Adam, welcome.
Thank you so much, Walton, for having me on your show.
Glad to do it. Talk about St. Nicholas and the way he gained the reputation for giving gifts to people.
St. Nicholas is a early 4th century, early 300s bishop of Myra, which is located on the southern coast of Turkey, what is today now Turkey, up against the Mediterranean Sea. He was pastor, or bishop of a church that St. Paul himself in the book of Acts visits and helps to found. And so there are deep roots there in Christianity. And Nicholas is pastor of that church. His connection with gift-giving comes from a particularly wonderful story about him that happens early on in his life before he is made bishop. He is just a young man, has inherited a certain sum of money from his deceased parents, and hears about a man in town who has three daughters and is on the door of destitution. They've become so desperately poor that the man is considering selling off his daughters. Mm. And Nicholas decides to do something about it. He bags up a bag of gold and in the middle of the night anonymously tosses it through the man's window. The money is found in the morning and used for one of the girls as a dowry so that she might marry out of her circumstance. Mm. He repeats the act two more times so that each of the other girls might be able to marry themselves out of poverty. And so it's a wonderful tale of generosity. And you can clearly see the connections with Santa Claus. Later tradition will embellish that story and add to it and say, and Nicholas one time came by the window and found it locked, and so dropped the bag of gold down the chimney where it landed in a stocking that was hanging by the fire to dry.
How about that? Now, how long did it take for that to happen, for this association with Christmas to occur?
The connection with Santa Claus, now, that is a product of the early 19th century America, especially in New York, where New Yorkers, prominent New Yorkers like Washington Irving and John Pintard and those in the New York Historical Society are trying to find some traditions, some roots that are European and they're reconnecting with their Dutch heritage. And so to be Dutch was to celebrate St. Nicholas, Sinterklaas. And so to make St. Nicholas cookies and to give gifts on St. Nicholas Day, all of that was what it meant to be Dutch. So by them retrieving St. Nicholas or Sinterklaas, and there you can see even the word morphing into Santa Claus, was all part of this attempt to create some traditions, to reconnect with some Dutch roots, and then it in the American context, of course, it gets broadened out and becomes a universally loved tradition.
How much of the way we stereotypically visualize Santa Claus today, at least physically speaking, as well as the whole scene, the North Pole, the reindeer, the ho-ho-ho. How much of that was born of the Coca-Cola advertising campaign?
A good bit of it was, in terms of the visual image we think of Santa Claus having. It really is a product of the early 20th century, as artists are now trying to represent this new Americanized St. Nicholas and depict him warmly and nostalgically and inside the home. And so Haddon Sundblom, working for the Coca-Cola company, really has the classic picture that we think of the rotund grandfather character who's jolly and cheerful and dressed in red from head to toe with the belt and the boots and everything. That really is a product of the Coca-Cola advertisements, and others were you're depicting a similar kind of image. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, as you see that standard picture, you think of it in your mind, obviously there is almost nothing there that connects him with a Christian bishop in terms of Christian symbolism. You know, he's lost mm-hmm. The staff, the crozier staff, and the mitre hat, and the stole, and you know, anything that might connect him with
yeah.
the Christian faith. Although in Europe, of course, all of the European countries and locales still celebrate St. Nicholas, and there you still see him very much as a in his bishop's garb.
Mm-hmm.
That's really only in the American context that he's now depicted really free of any of that.
You write also that St. Nicholas had real significance in church history. Would you comment a little bit about that?
He lived at an extraordinarily important time. When he was born, Christianity was a persecuted minority religion. By his death, it has not only been legalized, but it has become the favored religion of the empire. And so he oversaw a lot of that. He also attended the very famous Council of Nicaea, which your church history buffs out there will recognize
That's
as
right.
maybe the most important council in all of Christian history.
Mm-hmm.
And he was part of that, arguing for the faith. It's an important council because it really is at that council that we finally really hammer out who is Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, if Christianity is anything, it is about Jesus Christ.
Right. Yeah.
And so to have a really clear articulation of who is Jesus, is Jesus Christ, is the Son fully divine, 100%
mm-hmm.
divine,
mm-hmm.
Fully God, or somehow maybe a little less than God,
mm-hmm.
a product of God, a creation of God.
What made you write this book?
I had the opportunity to spend some time at the archive libraries in Bari, Italy, where all of these documents about St. Nicholas are. And so, you know, about 4 years ago, I was able to get a peek at these and realize there is a whole treasure trove of information about St. Nicholas and, you know, just this wealth of story to be told and realized, you know, oh my goodness, there's a real story here. So often we think of the story of St. Nicholas as being maybe the introduction to the story of Santa Claus.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to turn the tables and have Santa Claus be the epilogue
mm-hmm.
to the story of St. Nicholas. To
yeah.
me, St. Nicholas is really the story worth telling here.
Isn't it ironic that today a lot of people see Santa Claus as representing the materialistic side of Christmas, when in fact St. Nicholas represents just the opposite? Is that correct?
That's certainly correct. Although I would certainly add that from the very beginning of the early, you know, 19th century, when again those New Yorkers I was talking about started playing with the idea of St. Nicholas, he was even then connected with commercialism and advertisers and things like that.
Yeah.
So they were trying to sell stuff with Santa Claus even
mm-hmm.
then. But yes, you know, St. Nicholas, of course, gives us a model of charity,
mm-hmm.
generosity,
right.
Helping your neighbor out, and in gift giving. And it is a shame. It is ironic and a shame that his image now has become so melded with commercialism and consumerism and greed. And these are just the opposites
mm-hmm.
of what he himself stood for.
Well, one more personal question. In working on this project, did you learn anything that just clicked and changed the way you view the contemporary legend of jolly old St. Nick?
You know, what I really found, of course, I expected to find tales of generosity and tales of gift-giving. What I was really surprised to find was that St. Nicholas was also equally concerned with justice, social justice, civic justice. And so a lot of the other stories have him doing things that we would expect maybe a lawyer or a good politician or a judge doing. And that definitely surprised me. You know, we think, maybe just to connect it with Santa Claus, we think about Santa Claus at the North Pole with his lists of naughty and nice. And, you know, in that is an echo of this character trait that is there in the real St. Nicholas, as someone who is very concerned with naughty and nice, with virtue, with good behavior, and work tirelessly for, you know, social justice.
I've been speaking with Adam English, author of the new book, The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus, The True Life and Trials of Nicholas of Myra. It's a fascinating book, Adam, and I want to thank you both for writing it and then for being willing to come and tell the story of it on State of Belief Radio.
Welton, it's been an honor to be with you.
There's nowhere to hide from the carols, the sales, and the hype. Here to talk about navigating that environment, as well as about a deeper shared sense of purpose at this time of the year, is Rabbi Brad Hirschfield, one of my favorite guests on this show. Brad is the president of CLOW, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership, and I am so very happy to welcome him back to State of Belief Radio. Brad, welcome.
Thank you, Welton. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be with you.
I've come to know you as someone skilled in moving from the ridiculous to the sublime, which is why I'm...
My critics may say it's the reverse, but I trust you more than them.
Well, good, because that's why I wanted you on the show today. Because actually we're doing a little of both. So let's start with the former. With Hanukkah early this year, Jewish Americans have nowhere to hide from the total immersion, pardon the word, in Christmas that dominates our culture this time of the year. So what can they do?
Well, the first thing I would say is I don't think we have anything to hide from. And I mean that both on a political level and also a cultural level, maybe better, and also on a spiritual level. What I mean culturally is that one of the things that I truly love about America is that nowhere in the history of the Jewish diaspora over 2,000 years have Jews lived as comfortably, not just alongside, but along with people who are Christian, people who are Muslim, people who are atheist, Buddhist, every possible tradition. And so I would really tell any Jews who feel a need to hide is that actually that impulse to hide is a kind of denial of the magnificent history and present we have had and the future I think we can share, which has nothing to do with diminishing or the weakening of Jewish bonds, but has everything to do with appreciating that our roots can be quite deep and we can still be quite open in this culture. And that, for me, is a profound blessing.
Well, you have just reminded me of one reason that I don't like you on this show, and that is because I always feel less religious than you do. I mean, I really do appreciate you saying that, and I'm glad that that is a truth that can be held up. But, Brad, you know and I know that we Christians at this time of the year can be so single-minded that we are at least a bit, if not a lot, obnoxious. So how do you – I mean, when you get the full dose of Christian music and all of that and – somebody wants to say, I wish I could just be quiet, or I wish somebody wouldn't be talking about that. How do they handle that?
Well, there are a couple things. And first of all, I think context counts. I live in New York City, so I would have to admit that my certainty is that if I lived in Chattanooga, I'd have a different experience and therefore a different response.
Right.
And I do think that's important because it speaks to something, Welton, I know that you are careful about and have championed on behalf of others, which is that the larger the majority, the more sensitive that majority needs to be mm-hmm. to the needs of minorities.
Mm-hmm.
And so in New York, basically, it's all kind of a wash. I'm sure I love Christmas because we're a wash in Hanukkah too. And yet, if I lived in a community in which there were only a few hundred other Jews amongst hundreds of thousands of faithful Christians, it's a different experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess my guidance would be two things. First is I try and remind Jews that while there is no truth, and that's in the obvious sense, to the idea that people say, oh, yes, Hanukkah is the Jewish Christmas. No, it's not. But it is. And here's how it is. And I do say this, I'm saying it to you, and I say it to Jewish groups all the time. I think it is no accident that these two traditions, and there are others, I think it's in the core of Kwanzaa and other winter observances as well, promise their members, their believers, their followers, that we can all find the light and the warmth we need, even at the darkest and coldest time of the year, even at the coldest and darkest moments of our life.
Mm.
And so while there are profound differences between celebrating Hanukkah and celebrating Christmas, try and see in others what you love most in your own tradition.
Hmm.
And I think on this one, it's not even that much of a stretch.
Mm-hmm.
From a burning menorah to a lit-up tree to the promise of a little jar of oil, which is at the core of the Hanukkah story, how the oil lasted longer than anyone expected, to the promise of a largely unknown baby in a manger, and people imagining that that baby could and would become the Messiah. And at some level, that doesn't have to be a claim theologically, because imagine if we lived in a world where we came a little bit closer to treating everyone's kid as if they were going to be the Messiah,
hmm.
right? Imagine what that would mean for issues of child hunger and illiteracy and all the other things that whatever divides us deep down, most people, right, left, religious, secular, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, Buddhist, all know, you know what? We should do better on those things. We can do better on those things. And we must do better on those things. So that would be the first response. And then the other is I ask the Christians, try and invite a little participation from someone who isn't just like you. It's not that you should be less overt in the celebration of Christmas. I actually like that stuff. I like it when people wish me a Merry Christmas, because if that's the language of blessing that's near to their heart, then share it. But make sure you make it okay for someone who's not like you to wish you a happy Hanukkah or a happy Kwanzaa, or whatever else they're celebrating. Because for me, we're all at our best, not when we cut off or silence parts of who we are, but we make sure that others who aren't like us can be just as present and just as visible as we want to be.
My friend, you know that for many around the world, it's been a year, it's been a tough year, a year that involved loss and suffering. Many have known violence, and some great hopes have appeared and then seem to be dashed. What are some of the Jewish teachings that are applicable when getting ready for the end of a year like this one?
Oh, it's a great question, and I think I'll stay close to home in the sense that I'll look at the Hanukkah story. And I'm often struck by what it must have been like. You know, the Book of Maccabees and the Apocrypha tells the story, and then it's told again in the Talmud some couple of hundred years later. So this old story, a couple thousand years old. When those Maccabean soldiers went into the temple in Jerusalem, it had been ravaged by war. The menorah, the seven-branched candlestick that lit up the temple, that now we celebrate with eight because it's 8 days, the holiday, and they saw a little bit of oil. A little bit of oil that wouldn't burn for very long, and they decided they would pour that oil into the candelabrum and light it anyway, even though they couldn't possibly know if it would last. For me, the miracle that the oil burned 8 days didn't begin when the oil burned 8 days. It began when those first soldiers said, you know, Let's try. Let's dare to act as if a miracle could happen, and maybe it will. And I think that you combine that with the idea that actually, what if we really believe that each of us is also like that jar? That you and I hope, and certainly everyone listening, we all have more within us, more ability and greater gifts than we often realize about ourselves and almost certainly ever realize about each other. And what if we dared to treat each other like those jars of oil? And I think that that really is what allows us to say, okay, we know. If it doesn't work, the truth is it shouldn't have worked anyway. But it's amazing if we're willing to believe that it might and act as if it might, how often it could. And so it's to be able to hold on to a clear-eyed sense of realism without it ever invading the genuine optimism that should be a part of any faith tradition. I always say that anyone who claims to be deeply religious but is a pessimist, they must not be deeply religious. And so hold on to that optimism with a healthy dose of realism and dare to live as if you're that soldier who lit the light and as if you and the people around you are that little jar of oil that contains much more than most people realize.
Oh, that's really great. I want to ask you a personal question. What do you like to do on Christmas?
Oh, God, there are a couple things. First of all, I do like to go with my kids and see Christmas lights.
Mm-hmm.
And especially one family that we've been friendly with. The truth is the family we met who, in a childbirthing class, and I can't believe it, 20 years ago, before our first child, our daughter, was born. And we became very fast friends from very different backgrounds and very different religious backgrounds. And without even really planning it, an amazing tradition evolved where they would always come one night of Hanukkah and light a menorah and give gifts and get gifts and eat latkes, potato pancakes with us. And my kids would go shopping every year for a tree ornament for their tree. And it's a funny thing, because I'm an Orthodox rabbi whose daughters go shopping for Christmas tree ornaments. And I tell the story because I can honestly say at no time do I ever worry that it will diminish or dilute or confuse my kids. What I think they've actually learned is that when you love who you are really deeply, with real security, with a strong sense of attachment, it will allow you to love who other people are, even though it's not exactly you. I don't imagine any circumstance in which the Hirschfeld house will have a Christmas tree. But I also don't want to live in a world where anyone in the Hirschfeld family can't appreciate a Christmas tree's beauty.
Rabbi Brad Hirschfeld is president of CLOW, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. His most recent book is You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism. Brad, as always, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today on State of Belief Radio, and wish you a happy Hanukkah and a Merry Christmas.
I wish you the same, Welton. It's really an honor to be able to talk with you. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. Thank you. Merry Christmas, happy Hanukkah, and all good things.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. As we take some time to observe the holidays, we're bringing you some of our favorite interviews from the past 15 years of continuous weekly broadcasts. Please make sure you're signed up for our podcasts because there's some bonus content coming your way during these weeks. You can do that on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. Your donations help keep us on the air. We are so grateful. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.